the Grade Cricketer is a Twitter stream. It's about playing cricket at the grade level.
It's a tough, mean, dirty, dirty business being a Grade Cricketer.
A lot of cricketers, you know, that's all they know. They've done it since they're 10 and they have a deep-seated fear of change.
But the Grade Cricket is all about being the most alpha version of yourself as possible, at all costs and at all times.
I don't bat or bowl. I just feel a gully, count the number of dot balls in a row, sledge 15-year-olds. It's made me feel better about myself.
Thanks, champ.
Oh, no, you called me champ.
Hello and welcome to the Grade Cricketer podcast. Welcome back to the second week of this special South Africa series. And my, oh my, how special it's been, because the gift that keeps on giving, and I am talking about David Warner, has once again spruiked his head and given us as much content as we can, or that is possible, rather. My name is Ian Higgins. Stumbling through this introduction, I'm joined as ever by Sam Perry and Dave Edwards. It's a big show for the boys this week because Ed Cowan has announced his retirement. Friend of the show, Ed Cowan, who will be coming a little bit later. So we're going to celebrate his career and also perhaps get his thoughts on some things happening in the world of cricket right now. But in the meantime, much to discuss because I suppose we'll just start with the sledging, which couldn't have happened at a worse time for this podcast because it was literally happening as we were recording last week's episode. But for some reason, the news cycle has stayed true and helped us out, and we're still talking about the sledging. Dave Edwards, thoughts?
Oh, here goes, and great to be with you both on the podcast. But you'll remember, obviously, last week we did talk about how mateship is ruining cricket. Players from different countries are playing in T20 tournaments together, getting to know each other, and that was just bad for cricket. And then literally the next day, as our podcast comes out, both these teams nearly at blows over a sledge. They got quite personal in nature. I don't think this is what we were calling for, but these two teams aren't mates anymore, are they?
No, they're not mates. Pez?
Well, hello, everyone, and it's great to be with you guys, too, in case you weren't aware of that. But let's also not forget it is ESPN Champ Week, doesn't surprise me then that as that week has commenced, we got this news about Dave Warner and everything else surrounding it. I mean, I came into work, and this was kind of hot on the heels of Australia performing very well in this test match in a cricket sense, and by cricket I mean, you know, the actual bat and ball element of it, but that's not the story anymore. I got into work and all of the UK guys just rolled their eyes and said, gee, you guys are, you know, can we say cunts? Yeah, you cunts. And
you guys.
And we all carry that. We'll put the explicit rating on this week. And because that's how we're seen, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because that's how we play our cricket. We play it hard. What I want to ask you guys is, do we like it deep down? Do we like it? Are we proud of it? Or are you a wowser cuck?
Sam Perry's coming out throwing punches. Like, he's sick of being bodied on this podcast, and he's thrown some shots early. I think the big takeaway from this is just like, you know, if I can just skip to everything and just what's my takeaway, which isn't a question that you asked, but let me just answer my own question that I've given to myself.
Please.
And just the big takeaway is just, this is just grown men saying mean things to each other. Like, that's all it is. Like, you know, like.
Mean boys.
The fact that, it's mean boys, in whites with zinc on their faces and egg. But, like, I just think that, you know, like, people have sort of, like, they've for some reason felt like they've had to take sides over, like, you know, what Warner was saying some stuff, but, like, you know, de Kock, you know, made it personal. He crossed the line. But, like, for me, Warner was, like, sledging this bloke for, like, an hour on the field, and then it's tea. And you think, like, okay, maybe just cool your heels, maybe have a scone, maybe just a nice cup of, you know, Earl Grey over tea. He's, like, hammering him as he's walking off the field, calling him a fucking sook. He's, like, carrying on going up the stairs. De Kock says one thing, and, okay, it's not a good thing, but it's, like, you're sledging a bloke for literally 90 minutes, walking off the field, you say one thing, what the fuck did you say, mate? Like, and then just, like, to be having to, like, being held back. It's, like, you know, glass houses, David, really.
Yeah. Well, you can say anything you want, but that one thing, don't you dare cross that. That line, that imperceptible line that only Dave Warner knows and understands. I guess sledging, you know, it has been a part of cricket since the very beginning. I mean, I'm sure W.G. Grace was fucking ruthless, dishing out convict banter, trying to get on the Australian skin. But it's 2018 now, and we're still talking about what blokes talk about on the field. And it just fascinates the imagination. There's so many column inches dedicated to it. I saw Peter Fitzsimons came out, which just shows you that something's jumped the shark massively. But it just, you know, Things really shouldn't get personal on a cricket field, but they do, don't they? They just do. Why is that?
I mean, look at us. Like, we are just, we're so fascinated in cricket, and everyone is, by the social dimension. I mean, if ever there was, like, evidence that the game was actually boring, it's this, isn't it? Like, we just care about who says what to whom. It's this great thing, isn't it? Like, let's have it right. Like, Australia has created this whole, I'm going to say, this whole paradigm of sledging. Without Australia, this doesn't exist. Right. And so, and I love this scenario where, like, we invent this thing where we think there's this necessary condition to winning. It's not like a couple of blokes who just go a bit too far because they can't handle it.
No, it's mental disintegration.
We only win when we abuse people, right? Like, abusing people is this important thing we've got to do. Like, make no bones about it. Like, they think they need to do this to win. And then, so we do it, and we introduce it to other normal people who oppose us in games, and one or two of them are going to come back. And say something. Well, hang on. No, that's not the rules. Sorry, but if you're going to create the game, you're going to have to die by the sword. You know, that you struck out with.
I just love this fascination of sledging, because it's just like it's what you can't see. This like creates this deep fascination. It's why man traveled to the moon. It's why we keep going to the bottom of the ocean just to see what's down there. It's why men are so fascinated by lingerie. What we can't see, and like we want to know. We have to know. That's why lingerie sales are skyrocketing, is what I'm saying. Lingerie and sledging are exactly the same thing. That's all I'm saying. I'm now working for a PR company.
It's one of those things though, he goes, isn't it? Sorry, mate. Where like this does happen at grade level. I believe that the culture starts from the top. There's no revelation in that. But like, how often when you play cricket, and anyone listening to this show who's played cricket will surely identify this, at least if you're from Australia, but how often when you play cricket, you might have made 30, there might have been some very interesting reverse swing bowling going on. But really the first question is, what are they saying out there?
I do not care what's going off the pitch. Just tell me what he said to you, because I'm frightened of that. I remember Pez. Look, I've been sledged so many times, but one particular one sticks in my mind. Not for the content, because I won't go into that, because it was, you know, disgusting and can never be repeated again. But I made the innocent mistake of bringing an ex-girlfriend to my match at North Sydney Oval. She was up there sitting in the vacant McCartney stand, I think it is, or the Bob stand, the one on the. On the side, you'd know better than me, Pez, playing at number one a lot more times
Duncan
than I
Thompson?
Did. Whatever it was. Anyway, she was up there. She was there. There was no one around her. And some bloke from the other team. It was very obvious she was there to watch me, because she'd walked up as I entered the field. So all the team, the 11 players there, I'd watched as their heads rotated towards the stand. And then I was just subject to about 5 minutes, because that's about as long as I batted, of relentless sledging about who and whom slept with my girlfriend at the time. And they all gave me really good handshakes after the game, a lot of eye contact. Well played, mate, but come on, blokes. Come on. Really? Do you need to do this? Does this help? I actually got run out, so you didn't get me out. I got myself out by taking a shit single. So you didn't get me.
I just find like there's something about once you walk onto the field of a cricket match and you can wear your long white pants and your comfortable floppy brim and you can have some zinc on your face, then and only then can you say some of the most horrific things you wouldn't dare dream about saying in real society. Like, for instance, if you walked up to a 16-year-old shelf packer at Woolworths and you said to him, "You're the worst fucking bloke I've ever seen. I fucking hate you." Like, you would be forced out of the store and perhaps, you know, forced to shop at Aldi, for instance, for at least a year. But on a cricket field, like, it's just good aggression. You know, it's just like you're having a role in the
team.
He
plays tough.
But if you see, you say this shit out like in the real world, you know, this is essentially why they're in our lockout laws, because they're one punch victims.
Well, I realize what you're doing there, he goes, but like, I find the idea of someone telling me on the cricket field that they hate me to be like quite emotional. You know what I mean? Like, they're sort of, I hate you, mate.
I fucking hate you.
It's a very strong emotion. It is funny, isn't it, how you just have this in Australia anyway. There's this culture that exists where all of the normal rules of society and conduct between people is thrown out the window. And I think this does actually link to the Australian side, because what then happens in that pack mentality, and Smith's talked about it, is that somebody in this, you know, in this alpha cesspool of alpha men is going to try and be the most abusive, you know, because that's what happens in social dynamics, right? Someone has to be the sledger. And, you know, we see Australian cricket lauding the attack dog. I got given the attack dog role. Like, it's this great kind of medal, you know, bestowed upon this player. And so everyone competes. Eventually, it turns into what we saw the other day. I mean, you just push, if you just keep encouraging it, you're going to push someone to say something back. So I don't understand the hand-wringing and the kind of moralising over how bad de Kock's thing was. I mean, we created the monster.
Pez, I really enjoyed the angle that you took briefly on a tweet, if I can big up your own social media presence, in that, like, but Australia feel like this works. Like, this works. Like, that's why they keep doing it, and they're going to keep doing it. Tim Payne said in the press conference at the beginning of this test match, we're not going to change anything. We're not going to change the way we go about it. Like, so they're still, like, even though this has created this massive furor, they're still going to go about it because they believe that, not like, Australia is lauded for having this great bowling attack, you know, the best bowling attack going around in the world at the moment. Yeah, that's not good enough because you have to say really mean things to the opposition. You know, if your best bowling attack in the world, perhaps ever, can't get the batsman out, you just say mean things to them.
Oh, there's so much within that as well, Hugo. Yeah, I think I said, like, so long as Australia believes that verbal hostility is key to winning, then this stuff will keep happening. And, like, it's funny because verbal hostility is quite a complex thing. Like, I think there are certain people who have the maturity to understand how to use words to kind of distract or get under the skin of somebody without needing to kind of directly abuse them. But as we can see in the Australian side, there are certain people who probably lack the maturity to know what is kind of just direct abuse and what might be sort of witty or cunning. But the thing is, it's not that you can't blame the people who are abusing. It's just if you create that paradigm or create that culture where verbal hostility is a necessary condition of success, someone, you know, these guys are in their 20s. Like, they're still kids, you know, emotionally in a lot of ways. So someone's just going to say, like, you're going to continue to get guys who sledge and swear and abuse, and this stuff will keep happening. And, you know, and then I'll keep going to work and people will keep saying Australians are cunts. You know?
It's been happening successfully for so long for Australia. If you look back to...
Sorry.
When did things get really alpha for Australia? Probably the 70s under the Chapel reign and then progressively more and more alpha, border, war, and now to present day. Look, I just think that there's just a culture of sledging, and breeding results. So, and you look back to what Brad Haddin's performance in the last World Cup where he was, you know, sledging relentlessly the New Zealanders, the nicest blokes in cricket. And successfully, we won a World Cup, and he didn't shy away from that. So I think it's just systemic, isn't it?
Okay, can we ask, though? I mean, let's be honest. Does it work? You know, let's say every other condition is the same, is exactly the same, and the only variable is abuse versus no abuse. Do you think it makes a difference? I'm going to say, yes, I do, actually. I think when you go in as opposition and people are being being deliberately unfriendly to you and unwelcoming, that it does impact you psychologically. But the question is, does the moral dimension outweigh that? You know, like, is there a moral dimension that should be higher than that from a cricket perspective? Now I'm a cuck because I've said that, and I'm a wowser, you know, in Australian cricket culture.
Snowflake.
I think that's a really interesting point, Pez. But I think it does work, and I think that because of the margins that you're playing with at that elite level, and especially in a game like cricket where not only, like, you know, being an alpha is important by having a good rig, but it's such a fine motor skill sport, reaction times, that sort of stuff, you know, technique, all that kind of shit. But, like, at that level, if you have a guy who's... And this is what Steve Waugh said at the time when he introduced to society this mental disintegration idea, that if a batsman's distracted by 1% by something that a person is saying to him on the field, then it works. And I mean, this isn't just a thing that, like, you know, Steve Smith has introduced. This is something, as Edo's rightly points out, that Australia's been doing for probably 30, 40 years now. And it's just escalated probably because of things like stump microphones, exposure to players, you know, like we know more about Dave Warner as a personality, to, you know, just to keep picking on him. so I think it's just more in the public eye now more than ever.
It's funny you say that, Higgins, because... Look, I agree, and I just think most people understand that if they're abused in their workplace, they probably wouldn't perform as well. But I also do, like, resist or object to the idea that, like, what the Australians are doing is some kind of psychological masterclass. Because let's look at when it actually rears its head on a cricket field. It's when the Aussies are fucking pissed off that things aren't going their way. Like it's people letting go of their anger, like giving into their anger, and they start abusing people. And they might say, "Look, there's actually something. There's a deeper professionalism going on here." There's not. Again, these guys are in their 20s and they've just got the shits. When the De Kock thing happened, it was because Markram and De Kock were scoring a lot of runs. It was the same thing with Sawan and McGrath. Yeah. They just start abusing them. So I don't think that they're going to say, "Yeah, this is actually a tactic. It's a ploy." You can see the steam coming out of their ears. They're affronted that someone has bothered to stand up to them, you know?
There's such a pack mentality about sledging, though. I mean, is there any other sport where there are so many people on a field who aren't actually participating in the play? Because you've got two batsmen and you've got one bowler, and then you've just got 10 blokes.
Question time.
10 blokes who are just watching. Like, they can't influence the play, and they're crowding around the bat. They're getting in blokes' eye line. They're trying to influence, and how else do you influence other than that? Well, you talk, you say things, and you try to disarm and, you know, rock the batsman into making a mistake, and that's your influence. And you can fucking hold your hat on that at the close of play, even if you got a duck and took none for 80. You got that bloke out with that bloody good sledge. You fucking got under his skin because you said something really mean about his mother.
100%, and like the cultural cachet that is attached to being the great sledger in your side, like, can't be underestimated. I mean, surely you guys have experienced that at grade level. Like, you know, it's the I know I keep using this C word, and I apologise to anyone, especially my employers, if they're listening to this. But you know, you always hear in Australian cricket, like, you know, but he's got a bit of about him, and we kind of laud that.
So like, true.
It's like he's got this capacity to be an absolute dropkick of a person, and we're going to reward him and his place in the team for that. Like, I still remember my dad saying to me when we were watching, speaking of question time in Parliament, I was watching with my dad once, and he goes, "Mate, don't worry about Australian sledgers. These guys are the best sledgers. These are the pro sledgers." When you just hear people in the corner of Parliament, you're just calling something out. So now I'm imagining, like, imagine if you had the Australian cricket team on one side, you know, the opposition versus, like, the government of the day. I just wouldn't mind seeing. I'd tune into that. That's a TV show.
That is a TV show. Fuck, that's funny.
Well, I mean, this is now sort of gone off the field as well, because obviously I think it's well-versed. I mean, people who listen to this podcast are men and women of the internet, so they have the capacity to know exactly what Quentin De Kock allegedly said. But this has now spread to South African officials posing in a photograph with some blokes from the crowd who decided to be hilarious to turn up to the ground in Sonny Bill Williams masks. Mm. It's one of those things that only happens in cricket. Why do people dress up for the cricket? It's fucking embarrassing. And also, it must be grim going to a test match dressed up in, like, full face paint, full kit. Like, that's one of those things that's funny for, like, 15 seconds, and then you're like, "Oh, okay, there's just three sessions of cricket left." Anyway, I'm getting distracted. So there's two officials, and we'll speak to Dan Bredig in just a moment's time, who will tell us that, give us an update about what's happening with those South African officials. But it's a weird thing for these blokes to do, and if I can just carry on this monologue, but Gideon Hay, a friend of the show, Gideon Hay, was on ABC Offsiders this morning, and he actually was talking about the ICC code of conduct. I mean, as we know, Gideon always is talking about the ICC code of conduct, but he was citing section 2.2.4. That's actually incorrect, Gideon. It's actually 2.2.8. A man of such caliber should be doing better research, but, you know, I do a podcast, so I know more than Gideon Hay. But 2.2.8 of the ICC code of conduct, I can't believe I'm still talking, says using language or gestures that is seriously obscene, seriously offensive, or of a seriously insulting nature to another player support personnel, umpire, match referee, or any other third person during an international match. Now, that's like Gideon's point was that these officials were doing exactly as section 2.2.8 of the ICC code of conduct were doing, and he was suggesting that James Sutherland should be pushing for for these guys to be punished. What are your thoughts on these South African officials posing?
I mean, it is so dumb and it's disgusting, really. There's nothing more. I mean, you don't have to look at this in a binary way and say, "Oh, well, Warner caused it," and all this sort of stuff. Like, it's utterly disgusting. Like, I mean, the state of someone who thinks that putting on a mask like that and what it's supposed to represent, I can't even, like, you know, again, let me wowser it up big time, but it's just disgusting. Like, you know, cricket does have this capacity to attract absolute fucking dickheads around. Yeah. And how these guys, the South African cricket officials, saw it as cool to do that is beyond me. It's fucking strange.
You'd hope that they immediately realised it was a terrible decision that they'd done. I mean, it probably happened very quickly. These guys came up to them in Sonny Bill Williams masks. You know, you don't learn that on the job. You know, there's no induction, you know, for your new job that's going to tell you that these blokes are going to rock up with a Sonny Bill Williams mask and confront you like that. Yeah. So maybe they were taken aback. But to kind of be pictured smiling and to be a senior official at cricket South Africa, yeah, I think heads need to roll there and justifiably so.
Mm. Yeah, I tend to agree with you there, Edos, and I'm not someone who sort of like calls for heads when, you know, a politician makes an error or, you know, someone makes a mistake at work or whatever. But yeah, just in terms of like, if, you know, if I'm one of those guys who has a Sonny Bill Williams masks, like, I don't know any fucking Cricket Australia officials unless it's James Sutherland, you know, walking up to him. So I tend to think that these guys knew the officials, like they were friends of these South African officials. They must have been mates or something to then to walk up. So it's almost like it's quite predatory in a way. Like it's sort of pre-planned and like it's fucking mental. And I completely agree with that language that you use, Pez. I think it's fucking disgusting. And like for these blokes to have a job come Monday morning, I'd be astounded because any professional working in that field, at a high or the highest ranking, cricket. Job in the country in South Africa, like for them to make a judgment error like that is just ridiculous. Anyway, I feel like we've done justice to this sledging debate. I don't know how it's still in the lexicon, but it's still part of the conversation. Obviously, it's very difficult to talk about the test match going on right now because as we are speaking, day three of this second test match has occurred and anything that we say is going to be redundant. So to that point, Dan Brady's going to be coming up and then we are going to be celebrating Ed Cowan's career with great friend of the show, Ed Cowan.
Big day?
No, big night. I've got to clean up the last two wickets, sing the song, do the covers, sing the song, drink 42 beers in the sheds, have a shower, sing the song, publicly objectify my teammates' rigs, compare sizes, tell everyone how good I was when I was 17, go to a strip club, lie to my wife, then spend all of Sunday being an emotionally absent father and husband. Big nights start with grade cricket. Lying to yourself has never been harder.
Well, we have a debutant on the show today, but a great friend of the show nonetheless. He's the assistant editor of Crick Info. I'm talking, of course, about Dan Bredig. Dan, welcome to the Grade Cricketer.
It's a proud moment in my career, boys.
and ours too. Dan, I mean, obviously, yeah, we have great memories. You interviewed us many years ago when we released our first book, but it's great that we can finally return the favour and interview you. You're in Port Elizabeth at the moment, the scene of the crimes taking place, the salacious off-field crimes in Australia versus South Africa, alpha battle of this test match series. Can you just tell us what it feels like in the press box at the moment with so much sledging going on?
Well, I mean, one thing that's happened in the press box at this match so far is that there's someone who was there on day one who's no longer there. One of the two South African officials caught with the fans wearing the Sonny Bill Williams masks. He's been summoned back to Johannesburg to explain himself, and he's got a fair bit of explaining to do. So, yeah, it's a bit unusual the way things have panned out. There's certainly always a bit of heat between Australia and South Africa, but I feel like, the use of the media on both sides of the fence really has ramped up a fair bit.
Can you give us a bit of an insight, Dan, into like what happens to press relations, for example? Because a lot of you guys are mates and stuff, but you are still of nations. I mean, what happens with you and your colleagues, your South African colleagues, when it becomes this kind of tit for tat battle between who said what and who said the worst thing?
Well, there's always a bit of banter. Certainly, yesterday morning when I came into the ground, I bumped into Ken Borland, who is one of the South African journos and loves a bit of a wisecrack every now and then. And I made sure I searched him for Sonny Bill Williams masks before he came into the press box. it's that sort of byplay and banter that tends to bubble to the surface. But then, of course, you know, you will occasionally have differences of opinion on a more serious level about how the way things are covered. I mean, one of the things that is great about working for Crick Info is that I'm here working alongside Fidos Munda, and I'm generally on a tour. I've got a colleague who's based in the other country, and so you get a bit of a balance of views, and you can test if you've got a story idea or you've heard something, you can test that by going via your colleague to see what the view is on the other side of the fence. And I think occasionally with other organisations where they're just from the one country and they're just writing to a degree for that one country, things can be a little bit not skewed, but it's handy to have that ultimate perspective.
Mm. We're getting a picture, sort of. I mean, I'm in the UK, Dan, and these guys are back in Australia. We're getting a picture that it's particularly vicious at the moment. I mean, is that your feeling there as well? Is it bad? You know, where does this rank in the, you know, umpteen sledging wars that Australian cricket's been involved in?
Well, at this point, I'd say this is getting... It's not quite on the monkey gate level. It's not quite 07-08 in Australia because, you know, you had genuine threat of an Indian touring team going home there. So that's, you know, that's maximum alert level. This is probably the next tier down from it, but I can't think of another series where there's been sort of issue upon issue sort of cascading, one after the other. And even in the last 24 hours, the ball tampering, as I use the Christopher Pine inverted commas symbol, in terms of David Warner. So, and, you know, ironically enough, at the same venue 4 years ago where there was another ball tampering farrago. So, it seems like every morning you wake up, there's something new.
Dan, do you reckon that this is... I mean, Australia would have planned for this entire series, about the way they go about it. I mean, obviously, they sledge every team, and I like to think that they sledge every team equally. Mm. But they would have known that the South Africans were going to give some back. But do you think that this is going well for Australia? Like, this sledging tactic, this aggressive line of, you know, alpha versus alpha, but, like, on the field, like is this what Australia wants? Is this the outcome that they wanted?
They certainly don't want a situation where the CEO of Cricket Australia releases a statement about their behaviour. I think that's probably the if you're talking about crossing the line as the Australian team loves to do, that's probably a line they don't want to be crossing all that often. And that, I think, this is really the first time I've heard that sort of dialogue since Monkeygate, since 2007-08. So that's an interesting sort of cross current here. Certainly when Australia plays South Africa, I think they feel that, not that they've got license, but that South Africa play cricket in the most similar style to them of all the teams around the world. So it's, they probably put a few more shots in the locker, as it were.
So let me ask you this, like, sorry, Edo, can I just go on?
Please.
There's a comment that Steve Smith made to cricket.com.au last month, and it was talking about Kagiso Rabada, and it said it could perhaps be a plan to try and get him fired up. You never know what some guys do when they're fired up. He's obviously a quality bowler and a big player for them. You don't want to see guys getting suspended or anything like that. You want to come up against the best, but you never know. I mean, this seems like a pretty direct tactic by Australia to get Rabada fired up, because they knew that he was on the edge of getting a suspension, and now he's like he's taken the bait and he's basically brushed shoulders with Steve Smith, which looks pretty innocuous, but when you combine his demerit points all together, he's facing now a 2-game ban for the rest of the series. So I mean, this seems to me like a pretty decisive move by Australia to try and get blokes suspended, even though Steve Smith says that that's not what they're trying to do.
Well, as we know from Kagiso Rabada, the best tactic that you can possibly use to him to get him fired up is to get out to him. So, in that sense, on the first day of this test match, Australia did a wonderful job at getting Kagiso Rabada in the firing line of the umpires and the match referee. I think there's, something I'd say about Steve Smith as the Australian captain generally, not just in regards to this instance. He's pretty honest about what he's thinking and what his intentions are if you ask the right questions. He's certainly not someone who's going to wrap things up too much in... Australian cricketers use a lot of euphemistic language for the way that they talk on the field, but in terms of the fact that this is the system that they have now, there are demerit points, players are going to skirt close to the edge of suspension if they accumulate some. He was, I think, being, you know, quite... admirably honest that that's an element of the game now. And to be fair to South Africa, Faf du Plessis said pretty much the same thing about David Warner entering into this match.
Yeah, Dan, we just spoke off air a little bit about, I guess, the history of South African cricket. And you mentioned before that Australia and South Africa, they're quite similar, I guess, in their attitudes and their aggressive play on the field. But I'm just wondering about how you're finding it there. You're on the ground. You're kind of immersed in South African cricket. Can you kind of explain South African cricket to us and the role that history plays in it?
Yeah, well, the first thing that strikes you when you get here is that none of the grounds have changed really at all in 20, 25 years. So, you know, the stands are all the same, the vantage points are all the same, even, you know, stuff like the breezes coming in through the various gaps in the grandstands, all of that sort of stuff is unchanged. The wickets a little bit different in each venue with time and tide. But yeah, there's a sense of the unchanged here, which is very different to Australia. Like if you close your eyes and imagine the cricket grounds Australia were playing international matches on at home in the mid-90s, there's very little that's the same. Like compare the Gabba then to now, or compare the SCG and certainly Adelaide Oval then to now. And we didn't have Perth's new stadium. So there's an element of the unchanged, and that can feel really nice and nostalgic. But it's also a reflection that cricket is not as big a deal here in terms of the overall. You know, soccer is by far the biggest sport in South Africa. Rugby has an enormous following, particularly amongst the Afrikaner population. So, for instance, when we were in Durban for the first test, Kingsmead is a nice, you know, small ground. But then you've got two massive stadiums right next to each other, one for soccer and one for rugby, with capacities of 60 and 50,000, and they got about 40,000 to a Super Rugby game on the Sunday. It was the Waratahs playing of the Test match. So, you know, the place of cricket in South African culture and in South African popular appeal is a little bit more marginal than Australia, and in turn, that makes it all the more remarkable how successful the South African Test side has been.
Well, all I'm saying, Dan, is like, as long as they don't start bringing fucking Vuva lasers into the grounds like they did for the 2010 World Cup, my headache has only just dissipated from then. But can you tell us about the band that was playing all day yesterday for day two? This is being recorded on the beginning of day three, but day two, there was a band playing all day to the point where the umpires wouldn't resume play because until the band stopped. What was that about?
Well, I talk about continuity. That's the band, the Port Elizabeth House band, basically, that's been here since as long as anyone can remember. It was the absolutely consistent theme of Mark Waugh's 100 here in 1997, that the band kept going and going and going. And as he's subsequently said a few times, drive him mad, but I suppose in some ways that was perhaps the sledging that kept him concentrating. But it's just a part of the ambience of the ground, and it was quite extraordinary to see the umpires after a decision against Sashi Mamla that Kumar Dharamasena got pretty spectacularly wrong, to motion the band to shut up because we can't hear. Now, Mark Boucher, I think, raised a very good point that Port Elizabeth, however loud that band gets, is never going to be anywhere near as loud as Eden Gardens or any of the grounds really in India when things are really heaving. And one thing I've always loved about a cricket ground is that it's not tennis. You know, it's not a sport where everyone is expected to be quiet the whole time and the cricket goes on nonetheless. And I think, perhaps that was a bit forgotten yesterday.
But if someone fucking walks their dog in my eye line when I'm batting, I will be fuming. So that's something that never changes. One little thing.
Look, I'd like to see the band just try to walk across the sight screen, see what happens there. That'd be quite amusing. I think the back and forth between the umpires and the band after tea yesterday really did get quite amusing, particularly when the band and the fans surrounding them started to sing the South African national anthem. It was, you know, it was a little bit of a sort of a fight the power kind of moment.
well done, umpires, and well done, cricket. Dan, thanks for joining us, mate. That was great. We'll definitely have you back, and I appreciate the insights into what's happening in Port Elizabeth.
No worries, guys, and keep circuiting.
You sound like you've read that from a piece. piece of paper. We'll follow you, Dan. Thanks, mate.
All right. No worries, guys.
Lads, we talk about friend of the shows all the time, but really there's no better friend of the show than our good friends, Budgie Smuggler. Budgie Smuggler, I mean, if you want to be the most alpha version of yourself, don't worry about what you're wearing on the post-match circuit or even on the field or even matching kit, although that is very important. Worry about what's underneath your clothes, and I'm talking about wearing Budgie Smugglers on the field, on the circuit, and wear them in your heart as well.
He goes, wonderful introduction. I love that this is going to get more and more addy as it goes on. But let me talk about Budgie Smuggler. No, I mean, seriously, small Aussie company, started in a backyard. All their swimwear is made in Australia, but they can ship it anywhere. They can, and I think the thing that they want to talk about is custom smugglers. So it's not just this, they're not like the old Speedos, for example. Am I allowed to say a rival brand? I guess they'll let me know. But you don't get told what design you have, or you don't get, you can pick designs, but you can also design your own custom smugglers. You'll see them everywhere. We've obviously got to get a Grey Cricketer one sorted out. I think what we say we'd have last week, the bat and a ball and maybe a shower in there or something
triple,
like that.
I said but, Triple C. I said Century Circuit Shop. That's all I wanted to know. Yeah. I think as well as for some reason, and Eddows, you can probably back me up on this, all the great institutions in Australia start in the backyard. I'm talking backyard cricket. I'm talking Budgie Smugglers. I mean, just probably two of those, but, you know, to be fair. The Shoey, maybe, that probably started in the backyard.
Oh, no doubt it did. He goes, look, anything that starts in the backyard is right in my book. And I think anything that lets you assert your identity as well is right in my book. And, you know, by custom making your own set of Budgie Smugglers, whatever you might have put on them, you can really kind of make an impact at your club. And I think that's the real takeaway for all you Gradies out there.
How long does it take to make the custom smugglers?
It takes 4 to 5 weeks, Ian, to make whatever design you want. They're all made in Australia. And that's Budgie Smugglers, budgiesmuggler.com.au.
Are you upset that no one comes to watch you play cricket? Are you tired of no one appreciating you for the talented third grader you are? The Cricket Family is the first program dedicated to helping people like you feel relevant again. We have a database of over 1,000 out-of-work actors who can come to your games and masquerade as your friend, girlfriend, wife, parents, or grandparents, helping you create the perception that the people close to you actually care about what you do.
Great shot, Jason.
No, I'm proud of you, son.
The Cricket Family, helping cricketers feel relevant once again.
Well, here goes. We say that he's a great friend of the show, but it's more than that. It's more than that. It's basically the fourth member of the Great Cricketer, of course, we're talking about. The recently retired man, he scored 10,097 first-class runs, 25 centuries, 1-4-3 matches, 18 tests, batting average of 41.27. We've got to get through the numbers here. Most importantly, a high score of 136 against the Sathers. So never know if that's racial or not. In 2012, very pleased to welcome Ed Cowan to the show. Mate, welcome.
Welcome back, I think you need to say.
The most important statistic there, Eddows, is that this man has now been on the show four times. So we realise that we're taking up a lot of your Sunday evening, Ted, but thanks very much for coming on the show, mate. I suppose the biggest reason we've got you back is because you've made the big announcement to just focus on your grade cricket. So how hard was it to make the decision, mate, to call stumps on a glittering career?
Actually, before we get into that, I think it's worth noting that when I saw there was a new series of the podcast, I thought, well, we're going to need to give you some material. So I decided to retire. That obviously played heavily into the thought process. So you guys you'd be stuck, and you'd be asking me on the show anyway, we should on guests. So we might as well talk about something. Look, I've been thinking about it for a while. I'm 35, so I'm no spring chicken. And, you know, it's nice to go out when people are sort of saying, oh, you know, you could have eked out another year or five. Couldn't really. Wasn't doing much with the bat. So it was time to give it away.
Did you think about eking out anymore? I mean, when did it happen? When was the moment that you just went, I'm calling a press conference? when did that moment take place?
There'd been a bit of a build-up, to be honest. And even speaking to, you know, Hugo's over Christmas, the structure of the Aussie summer these days, you only played two games before Christmas, and then you have 10 weeks off, and then you start the Shield season for 5 weeks again. Sort of felt like I'd given up a whole year to not do much. So
cricket in a nutshell.
As you get older, it's like, can you justify doing this again? And the answer probably was no, basically.
Mate, I don't want to keep harping on the point, but like, I mean, as you say, like the structure of the season now is such that it's just like it's really hard to get into a rhythm these days, because it's sort of the Shield aspect, as you say, is broken up into a couple of bits. But like, mate, how instrumental was the decision at the beginning of the year where you were sort of left out of the New South Wales side, and you know, decisions were made to, you know, play some younger blood, you know, in those earlier Shield games, and where you were left out after obviously such a great season last year where you were leading run scorer and New South Wales player of the year. I mean, like, how heavily did that impact on your decision now to say that'll do?
Yeah, it was a pretty big impact, to be honest, in a sense that probably got me thinking. I probably thought the end of next season would have probably been about time. I think at the start of this season, I'd sort of come in thinking, maybe if I can just sneak a few hundreds in at the start of the season, maybe I could, you know, play a little with Ashes cricket, and that's such a massive carrot. So to have that sort of ripped out sort of started the process of, you know, maybe I am the old bloke who's clogging up the system. Maybe it is time to actually start thinking about this. So I would say that probably started the ball rolling.
Sure.
And then it snowballed from there.
And it was an intervention by Steve Smith as well. I mean, the captain of Australian cricket, to kind of, I guess, intervene and make sure that, I think it was Daniel Hughes, was opening the batting because they saw here a future for him in Test cricket. I mean, coming from the top, that must have influenced.
Yeah, it was a pretty clear message.
Smackdown.
It was pretty black and white.
Yeah.
All right. Well,
it was very black.
I mean, like, we're sort of, you know, started on a tone of, like, how this all ended. But, I mean, there's so many things that you've achieved in the career. I mean, you've done everything that pretty much every boy playing in the backyard wanted to do. I mean, the amount of test matches you played and the tours you've been on, et cetera, it's been a wonderful achievement. But, like, I mean, what's a couple of the things that you sort of take away from it? Is the Shield victories down in Tassie, or playing for New South Wales, or even those test matches here and abroad?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think my first sort of reflections have been pretty overarching of, you know, rather than the moments that people might sort of pick out for you and you do these interviews. People say, you know, what about the Test century or the Shield wins? And yes, they are massive moments of a career, but I actually think it's been like the shared moments with mates, either, you know, after a game, on the circuit, of course, you know, great partnerships with, you know, I remember vividly, one of my finest memories in cricket is batting with George Bailey at the Wacker, and I think we put on 200, and, you know, so we're best mates, just having a ball, and then we went to a concert that night, and, you know, just living life.
Just a great day.
Loving it. It was like the greatest day of my life. So, and it was like in these vineyards in Perth, on the outskirts of Perth, and we're driving back at midnight, and Dools was on his way to scoring a Test 100 on the radio. It's like all these perfect alignment. It's moments like that that I actually reflect on and think, geez, I've had it pretty good. So, yes, you know, the shared memories and efforts of Shield wins, Test wins, that kind of thing, you know, is still at the forefront of my mind. But it's probably the moments of being proud of people who have been on the canvas and picked themselves up, and, you know, you're out in the middle when they get 100 or similar, you know, hundreds if you'd been battling and, you know, you piece it together. So it's probably my point being, and I've rambled a bit, it's the moments people don't really recognise that tend to be the ones that people do internally.
I mean, how do you want to be, just such a basic reflection question, but like, how do you want to be remembered? I mean, you were always respected as, I guess, a voice of reason and rationality in a world of rigs and maximums, you know, a thinking cricketer, you know, who wasn't afraid to kind of, you know, say what he thought about cricket and the setup. So how do, you know, if people were, let's God forbid, you know, if someone was to write an obituary on Ed Cowan right now and his impact on cricket, what do you think that would be, or how would you like it to be?
It'd be a short one. I think if someone wrote, good team man, decent player, hard to get out, you know, loved hanging out with him, I'd be pretty happy.
Lovely.
I thought you might get in there, that you hit 5 sixes at Rabie Oval yesterday, which you were pretty desperate for me to find out about organically just by going on My Cricket. Like, I wasn't going to do that anyway, like I always do.
By sending you a photo with the highlighted bit that I did yesterday. Have a look at this, mate. Might want to mention this on the podcast.
I thought that might be the opportune moment that you might bring that up, that Ed Cowan now hits sixes and he's available for the IPL circuit, even though Martin Guptill can't get a gig, but Ed Cowan, left-hander, that's the secret. Ted, I mean, this is all...
And leg spin, about 14 straight the other day.
We're not talking about your leg spin, mate. You're not coming on my podcast and talk about your leg spin.
My podcast. Own everything.
I mean, this is all about, you know, roundabout way of, like, you know, asking you, you know, where meeting the great cricketers comes in your career. Like, would it be top five? Would it be a podium? What are your thoughts?
Look, one of my reflections has been gratitude towards the people that I've met in the game. There are people that are now in my life, you know, probably more, in your case, more than I'd probably like, that I wouldn't have known cricket, you know, if cricket wasn't a thing for me. So, you know, you are, there's just so many friends I've met along the way that, you know, randomly, that otherwise wouldn't have happened, so... But yes, top five, that's ridiculous. Even top 20.
All right, well,
Broadchurch.
You're someone who's played...
Never buy a beer, here goes. Come and see you. Would you like a beer? Yeah, mate, yeah. And then you just, yeah, I'll have another one, buy a few beers and see where the friendship goes.
Well, this definitely won't make the final edit. You've played against South Africa, Ted. You've obviously scored 100 against South Africa as well. Mate, there's some of the stuff that's been going on recently. Obviously, the sledging is like a big thing. But, like, I think you've come on the show before and you've actually said that these countries are so similar and they're one of the guys that you can actually have a beer with after the series. Like, but right now, mm-hmm. the tensions just seem extraordinarily high. Like, I mean, some of the guys who are in this current team you would have played with and against the South African team. Like, does this surprise you what's going on, you know, sledging-wise at the moment?
Doesn't seem like they'll be having too many castle lagers together after the series. but they probably will. Hard but fair, mate. You've got to play hard but fair and have a beer with them after. And,
yeah.
I know I called you fat and useless, but have this and get this down your gullet. Yeah, well, mate. Oh, yeah, mate. Till next time, yeah, we'll play. So, what was the question?
Are you surprised? Are you surprised that these go, like, everyone hates each other?
It's just not a good look, is it? Am I surprised? Yeah, I am a bit surprised. It shouldn't be like this. You know, I think, and I have no idea why it's got to this point. So, I'm not there. I don't know what's been said. Mm. So, it's hard to comment, but...
Mm.
As I said previously, these two teams are actually usually teams that do get on. There is always a little bit of tension because it's a big series. They're, you know, probably the two better teams in the world in their own conditions. So,
yeah.
It's just not a good look. It's been a good test match, this one, though.
Yeah, it has been. I completely agree.
So, as I said off Ed, we got some listener questions. We put it out there. You've obviously retired this week. And we wanted to put it in the hands of the listeners because, you know, there's a lot of people out there that love you and have asked some strange questions and some interesting questions. So we'll get through them.
I'm good for it.
This one comes from an actual cricketer, Ben Dunk. He says, maybe ask Ed how he got back to the hotel after day four of the Shield game in Alice Springs in his last year with Tasmania. Thoughts?
I was nude.
Right. And how did you become nude?
I got myself nude. Like, there was no force. You know, I just had a few briefly. There's something about, you know, going loco. It applies when you're in the Northern Territory. You just go just a little bit Tropicana. And I had a few beers and next minute, nude, walking the street. I wasn't the only nude person cruising around Alice Springs, to be fair. But thankfully, I just had a little, you know, stubby. That's all I need, just to cover the appendage and walk back.
Throwback or real?
No, throwback. Those little 200 mil.
All right, strong start from these questions from the fans. Next one is, please don't mention my name on the air. I met Ed Cowan briefly at the airport as he was departing. I mentioned I was part of the Ed Cowan Appreciation Society. He seemed genuinely thankful. It was an eclectic group of cricket fans bonded over our appreciation of OME, our man Ed, and his approach to the game. That's not a question, but that's just a nice message. Do you remember that encounter at the airport?
I do absolutely remember. He was a customs officer. Chat to him. I didn't actually know the group existed. It was a bit embarrassing. I've since joined it, obviously, and post regularly. started it, yeah. Lovely group of people.
It's not unsettling that there's a secret society of men. I bet they're all men who have bonded over your approach.
Over the years, it's fair to say I've copped my fair amount of criticism, so it was nice to have someone or a group of people, albeit small, show some appreciation, I must say.
This one is from David Brooker. I played for Sydney Uni and Ed ran fielding one pre-season training session. He didn't talk or make eye contact with me as I was in fifth grade at the time. Still seemed like a nice bloke and helped improve my fielding. It's not a question. His name's David
Brooker. Who's this bloke?
Never heard of him. Lie. Lying.
Perfect. All right. Andy Nixon says, can you ask Ed what is his favourite national song? He's my second favourite Aussie cricketer. Ponting is number one. After seeing he was at their concert recently, he's got substance. And then a comment.
Mandela, cry, baby, cry.
Oh, yeah, great closer. Oh. It's a great closer.
That's the concert that Bales and I saw in WA as well. That's one of the best ever. It's favorite strong. Band. 200 strong, in the middle. Yeah. It's a free-for-all.
All right.
I two more Mistaken for Strangers because it reminds me of getting brushed in grade cricket. Like, you get mistaken for strangers by your own friends. Just cricket.
Yeah, great line.
All right, Tex. We've got two more.
Moving along. This one's from Abby. Hi, great cricketer. Love your writings and podcasts and the humour insight you provide. Whoops, we shouldn't have left that in. Oh, looking forward to your episode with Ed Cowan.
This is Sam Perry's service. Yeah.
Anyway, I have a close encounter of the Cowan kind to share. For my Year 10 major English essay, almost 4,500 words, I chose Ed's book, In the Firing Line, as my text for analysis. Being 15 years old at the time, I posted about it on Instagram and have been honoured in the 3 years since Ed not only wanted to read the essay, but has been, along with his family, friendly and kind to my entire family and I whenever we have seen him at New South Wales matches. This is probably confirming many intellectual cricketer stereotypes, but the one I'd like to confirm most is that Ed Cowan is a thoroughly good bloke who is generous and thoughtful. In cricket, Abby. Again, not a question, and he's done the in cricket thing, which is questionable, but no, nice sentiment from Abby.
Mm.
Read the essay. Critiqued it.
She got thoughts on it? A+.
That was fantastic.
What was the question? Like, what was the kind of prism, I guess, that they were analysing the book through?
I can't. Is it, we're talking 3 or 4 years. It was probably 4 years ago, but yeah, I think it was cricket. Thematic, talking about the thematics of overcoming adversity and,
change.
Change. Yeah.
All right, exactly. Ted, this is the last one. This comes from Joe Robinson, and he says, for Ed Cowan, is George Bailey the best test captain Australia never had?
Yes.
Why?
I love, my affection for George.
It's come up.
You could say, is George Bailey the best prime minister we've never, put anything in there, and I'll say yes.
All right, Ted. Well, I know you're short for time. We've got you during a dinner party that you're hosting, which neither of us were invited to, but I'm not bitter about that at all. Mate, I just want to say congratulations.
You know how cricket takes away from all these family functions? All the family weddings, parties, you name it. You retire, and then here I am on the, giving up a family night to talk to you blokes on a Sunday.
Talk about great cricket. You've obviously got the tripod coffee business. You're obviously involved with Banning for Change, looking after Ryan Carter's role there as he goes overseas. I mean, you obviously got your media commitments as well. You're obviously coming on this show 8 times a year. What's going to keep you busy apart from, hitting balls at Sydney University?
No, there's plenty in the wings. He goes, it's time to get a real job. So I'm working through that, and hopefully July 1, I'll find somewhere to start.
Mate, that's awesome,
Keep
mate. That's awesome, mate. And as ever, we thank you sincerely for all the time you've given to us and all the kindness you've shown for us during your playing days. And hopefully that continues for many more years to come. Thanks as ever, mate, for coming on the show. And no doubt we'll be speaking to you again soon.
I hope so. I hope you don't brush me now, but I'm like one of those past players.
Get to us. No social capital.
Exactly. Done.
Thanks a lot for that, mate.
Later.
Appreciate it.
Love Thanks. You guys. Bye.
Thanks, mate. Bye.
I don't play cricket for results. I don't come to take wickets, score runs, or win games. I play cricket to look good. Rigs, chests, pipes, circuits, salads. This is my domain. So when I hit the sheds, I need to radiate success. That's why I use Chop King Cologne by TGC. With a blend of the finest handcrafted English willow and Kookaburra Red King leather, Chop King Cologne lets me radiate cricket. Whatever the ground, whatever the circuit. Chop King Cologne, the new fragrance for men by TGC. Reek of runs without hitting them.
An absolute treat to talk to best friend of the show. We just want everyone to be our best friend on the show. I don't care if it's Budgie Smuggers. I don't care if it's Dan Brittig. I don't care if it's Ed Cowan. Everyone's just a really good friend, and that's why you play cricket, to make friends. Sam Perry has joined us back onto the show just in time for hashtag AskTGC. I say it's my favourite time of the week, and it often is when you get the good questions. I know we asked listeners for some Ed Cowan-related questions this week, and of course we did ask for hashtag AskTGCs. We've got three quite longish ones here today, but I think you're going to enjoy this today, lads. So let me kick this off with Justin Hall, who says, "Hi guys, long-time listener, first-time messenger. I was just seeking some clarification on a situation. Generally speaking, I bat number 5, occasionally number 4, with an average of 37.5, and I feel that square leg to square leg. This weekend, we had the chance to qualify for finals, and we only needed 155 to win from 40 overs. However, I had my university graduation and decided to take the weekend off, assuming my teammates could get the job done after they were 1 for 50 off 6 overs. Upon completion of the graduation ceremony, I checked my phone to a barrage of messages that there was an almighty collapse of 6 for 18, and we had eventually fallen 60 runs short. The boys had abandoned me. Not one return call or message. Even the Twitter mentions had fallen by the wayside. I just wanted to know if my decision was justified, considering I achieved the elusive GCC, graduation, circuit with a far superior and intellectual university mates, and chop with a uni bird I have had my eye on for 3 tumultuous years. Cheers, lads." Excellent question, Justin Hall. So, lads, was he justified by getting his own version of the Triple C, the GCC, in his life, and by missing the chance to make finals with the boys?
Oh, here goes. What a question. I never even considered going out after my graduation, or graduations, plural. It was just a formality. You know, you turn up, you walk on stage, shake hands, have maybe one glass of champagne on the quadrangle, and you're done by 3 p.m. But I think your teammates are just jealous of you, the lack of responses, because you have achieved the holy trinity of life. I mean, we talk a lot about the CCC. Nothing beats the century, don't get me wrong, but that feeling subsides by Tuesday when you have a shit net.
A lot of narratives are based on that idea of escaping, escaping your local community, escaping your local town, escaping prison. And I think this is quite similar to that. This is, I mean, essentially, Justin's gone on to pastures new. He's completely correct to say, he's two roads have diverged in a wood there. For Justin, he can see the collapse in the final, and then he can see a graduation circuit chop. He's absolutely taken the right decision. He's sort of implying, slightly arrogantly, I might say, that were he at the game with his average of 37.5, and he has put the decimal place in there as well, that the result would have been different were he there. You guys are 6 for 18. Your friends text you after cricket. I'm presuming that you would have been caught up in that collapse as well. Yeah. So all the more reason, I'd say, to have gone to the graduation.
I sort of touched on this point last week, and I was doing some more research on it this week, but I just, there's sort of like this philosophical experiment, and it's called the think tank. Now, bear with me here, boys. So this thought experiment was proposed by philosopher I think his name was Robert Nozick, or words to that effect, or words that names that effect. And the idea of this think tank or this thought experiment was to refute the philosophy of ethical hedonism. And so hedonism suggests that the only thing that matters is human pleasure. That's all that matters. And the only thing that should exist is anything that maximizes pleasure. So if hedonism is as suggested according to this Robert Nozick guy, then everyone would immediately elect to plug into the experience machine. So the experience machine was basically like you go into a lab and you talk to these scientists and you say, give me the perfect life. And they ask you what your perfect life is. Mm. And I was sort of touching on this last week. Like if you had the perfect life, would that involve, you know, playing cricket? You know, you could play 150 test matches for Australia, averaging 6 million if you wanted to. You could fly if you wanted to. Anything was possible. And once you plugged into the machine, you would have no memory of ever going into this experiment. It would just be normal to you. So, and Nozick hit the conclusion of this, Nozick said that most people wouldn't go into the machine because proving that there are things that humans value more than their own pleasure, and that pleasure for the sake of pleasure leaves us lacking something that's important. So like going through all the trials and tribulations as is experienced in any grey cricket season, I think is what Robert Nozick was concluding is important. And I think that's my point.
I know we love to stretch metaphors on this show, but I think that is the biggest stretch I've ever encountered in my life.
He goes,
you spent too much time on Wikipedia today.
Are you all right?
That is rare. That's fucking rare from you, mate.
That's the rarest thing I've ever heard you say. Me. So should he have played or not?
So he should have played. He should have played is what I'm saying, because he thinks he's got happiness by going to the graduation and having sex with a woman who he's had his eye on for 3 years. But in actual fact, he should have been in the batting collapse.
What we've just said to you is extremely unfair as well, he goes, given that like we all encourage each other to go as wild and tangential as possible. You're merely doing what we agreed. Yeah. And as soon as you've done it, we've just cuckolded you.
No, I'm all for it.
I wasn't even aware. I wasn't even watching. All right. Question asked and I don't think answered, Justin. Richie Kenner writes in using the hashtag AskTGSaid, and he says, lads, long-time listener, first-time AskTGCer. I'm in a desperate need of some life advice, which is one of the best things that you can do, and come to this hashtag RCG segment. I've been living in the Midwest of the US for the last couple of years. As you can imagine, cricket is not part of the overly indulgent sporting diet over here. So much so that I've been reduced to catching Pakistan's Super League highlights on ESPN8, the Ocho, to get my cricketing fix. During one of these late night guilty pleasure sessions, I came across a poorly produced and acted commercial for Cricket USA. Safe to say Spielberg or Ron Howard were not involved. It got me thinking, maybe I pulled the plug prematurely on my fledgling cricket career. After 5 years of lower grade cricket in Sydney, including Colts, yuck, followed by 7 years playing cricket in the sauna that is Singapore, which can only be described as a human rights violation, I saw my move to the US as a convenient excuse to finally hang up the spikes. But something snapped in me that late and lonely night on the couch. I spent the next 2 hours Googling the various different cricket associations and affiliations in the Midwest. To my surprise, I discovered multiple local clubs in my home city of Cincinnati. With our first child on the way, should I continue with this madness and risk my future sanity as well as the future of my young family? Or should I seek professional help for this horrible disorder? Thoughts?
Oh, well, firstly, massive congratulations to Sticks on the news. I did watch him play in one match in Singapore when I was over on a business trip, and it was fucking village. It was just a bunch of bloated blokes trying to relive their youth while hiding from their wives. Good blokes, though. I like that he's only given two options here. He's just said, I either pursue cricket or I seek professional help. Is that the only two options available to him? Well, I either play cricket or I go to a doctor.
It's funny, isn't it? Because when you think about like moving to the Midwest, you just think of how great all the different sport over there would be. Like, why would I want to enmesh myself within cricket when I'm as far away from the game culturally and geographically as possible? But then again, I think about how good the USA one day kit would be at the World Cup. You know, like maybe Richie could play a World Cup for the USA. I say, you know, just completely disrespectfully to every other cricketer in the US. But, like, I mean, maybe that would be good. Like, it might be a shortcut way to being a pro sportsman in the US, which is one of the ultimate dreams. So perhaps you should take it back up.
I think my big takeaway from this is that we've finally beaten Robbie Williams and we've cracked the US market. Sean Herbst writes in for the last hashtag AskTGC of the week. And his question is a very long and thought-provoking one, but I think it's worth discussion. He says, hashtag AskTGC, up until the late 90s, a girthy behemoth of a human was the archetypal alpha rig. Being able to sink piss, spin low brown yarns, and compare sizes simultaneously in the change rooms was the economy of the alpha. And stocky rigs were the currency. Anyone who actively worked on sculpting chisel pipes and cared about their appearance was a fucking rare unit. Fast forward to the 2000s, and the tables have turned. The girth boom had busted. Stocky rigs were no longer in demand. In fact, a bit of pudge was now deemed as sloppy, beta even. The contemporary rig was in, and it wasn't long before even every change room hierarchy was commanded by a chop connoisseur resembling Tyrigosaurus Rex. That's rare. The question is, were these evolving attitudes reflective of a global change of outlook post 9/11? The shift from blasé border control measures and tolerance of security mediocrity to the precise, calculated, and fear-driven regimes that followed can be the only explanation. After all, the fine-tuning of rigs that preceded was uncanny, and nothing strikes fear into an Oppo change room more than a collective of alpha rigs. As such, do we have Osama bin Laden to thank for cultivating a cultural appreciation of glorious rigs? Do Australia owe Al-Qaeda for the production of Watson, Simons, Marsh and Stoinis? Is James Sutherland the cricket equivalent of George W. Bush? Who is the rig mastermind? Should I spend more time on my degrees and less on hashtag AskTGCs? Any answers will be carefully considered. Regards, Shane.
Lots to consider there. I mean, firstly, yes. in entirety.
Yeah.
I think there's an Australian identity issue within there as well, but I'd never considered that Australian identity had ultimately been shaped by Osama bin Laden's heinous actions, and I'd never made the connection between bin Laden and Stoinis before, but now that I think about it, I think Shane Herbst, I think you call him Sean Higgos.
Oh, do I? Sorry. That's
might be on something. That's no, all right. Yeah, alpha
I agree. I mean, yeah, the Al-Qaeda attack obviously had a huge impact on the world and, you know, shaped American foreign policy for the next decade and so, etc. But I think now that I do think about it, you know, it makes sense because I think it was about 18 months down the track that Warney got busted for taking a diuretic to look good. So that was less than 2 years after 9/11. So that can be directly attributable to the 9/11 terror attacks. And I think the metrosexual movement started around then, you know, queer eye for a straight guy. It was a new era of masculinity, you know, a new rig, a wax sculpted, honed, not outdoors, but in like a fitness first gym, paying $30 a week to do buys and chest 4 times a week. That's all directly attributable to 9/11.
And I suppose in the spirit of understanding that rigs is like fashion. Rigs are like fashion, you know, so things go in and out. What are the political machinations going on right now, what with the Trump era, etc., and what impact will that have on rigs down the track? Will we see a return to the more sort of Cameron Smith style rig with perhaps not as defined abs but hairy chest, hairy strong chest, back to the stocky rig? I mean, the world is undergoing is reacting to globalization at the moment, right? I mean, we're actually trying to shrink. If you look at Brexit, if you look at what the US is doing in relation to Mexico and everybody else, people are actually moving back into they're trying to shrink. will the shrinkage, politically speaking and societally speaking, result in people going back to a sort of a more sort of an old school style of rig? Thoughts?
Well, I think this all comes down to minimalism, Pez. And I think for generations, people have been trying to, you know, a lot of people don't want to get big; they just want to tone. And that's what Brexit is. It's just trimming down. You know, I want to say trimming of the fat, but I feel like it's a metaphor that people can draw and stretch too far. And that's not what I'm trying to say. Yeah. I think people just want to stand on like those vibrating machines and just have like a band around their waist or like around their thighs and just, you know, spot reduce fat. People are always trying to spot reduce. That's not how it works. You have overall change. What I'm saying is I think the wall's going to go up and Mexico's going to have to pay for it.
Well, sorry, he goes, I would have thought Brexit meant chest and pipes were out and that kind of like bricklaying strength was in.
Yeah, you know what I mean? I think Brexit and Trump equals like Bruce Willis in Die Hard, like a white fucking tank top with like hairy shoulders and like a big chest.
Yeah.
That's what I think Brexit is. So it doesn't make sense.
Yeah,
to me
whereas the metrosexual movement and tonnage, etc., that was more Eurocentrism.
Obama, I think, yeah, 2008, like post-GFC, you know, regeneration, Democrats in power, you know, a greater global appreciation of America, and now we're going back to protectionism and so forth, border security, etc. That just, to me, screams Bruce Willis in Die Hard rig.
Brexit is old school alpha, the old style of alpha, isn't it?
Yeah.
Trump is old alpha, Brexit is old alpha, and therefore the stocky rig might be coming back.
Did that answer that? Yeah. He goes, he's convulsing.
He is.
And that's the end of the show. Maybe forever. I'm not sure. Thanks as ever for tuning in. Dan Bredig was on the show. Ed Cowan was on the show. My name is Ian Higgins. I'm signing off with Sam Perry and Dave Edwards. We'll see you again next week. Who knows what we're going to be talking about. Probably sledging again.